This is Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. Welcome. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features fun, fascinating stories about people in the performing arts, actors, authors, dancers, writers, musicians, athletes, you name it. Folks who are center stage, backstage, on camera, or behind the scenes. Sit back and listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a proud production of the Foul Players Group and the official podcast of the Foul Players of Perryville.
Hi, this is Kim of Kim's Crypt, and you're listening to Foul Players Radio.
Hi, this is Bud Becker, and you're listening to Foul Players Radio.
Hello, this is John Piatt,
Kevin Schmidt,
and Jerry Bozick.
And we're August, the little band from Virginia. You're listening to Michael Spedden on Foul Players Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Season 10 of Foul Players Radio. I would like to thank all of you for your support for the past 9 seasons. We hope to keep improving, bringing you more and more great episodes this year. Tonight's guest, Mary Jo Peel, best known for her portrayal of Pearl Forrester, the mother of the evil Dr. Forrester on Mystery Science Theater 3000. She was also a writer on MST3K and has appeared in Cinematic Titanic and Riff Tracks. We also discussed her 2 books, Employee of the Month and Other Big Deals, and Dum Dum Dum, My Mother's Book Reviews. I read them both this past summer, and they're both great reads, very funny stories in both of them. Also, we had a discussion about stand-up comedy. Is it the most difficult type of performing, or is it perhaps sword-swallowing? Come hear how a shy young lady got into comedy and ended up on the writing staff and in the cast of one of the most popular cult television shows of all time. Her website is www.mjpeel.com. That's mjpehl.com. The Foul Players of Perryville will be performing on the Western Maryland Scenic Railroad on Monday and Tuesday, February 13th and 14th, 2023. The show will be Curse of the Scroll, and tickets are available at www.wmsr.com. For more information on the Foul Players of Perryville, you can follow our website, foulplayersofperryville.com, or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And now, Mary Jo Peel, right after these words.
This is A.D. Adams, and you are tuned in to Foul Players Radio with your host, Michael Spedden.
Yeah, hi, this is David Simmons from DC Star, and I am just encouraging all of you to tune in to Michael Spedden's show on Foul Players Radio and love the rock and roll of the past and the art of the future.
Hello, my name is Gunil Carling, and you are listening to Foul Players Radio, and I am interviewed here, so tune in.
And folks, welcome back to Season 10 of Foul Players Radio, and today I'm proud to sit down with Mary Jo Peel. You'll know Mary Jo from lots of things. One of the big things that she's done in her career was Mystery Science Theater 3000, the role of Pearl Forrester, as well as being a writer on that show for many years. And she's also written some books that we're going to talk about today, too. So, Mary Jo, welcome to Foul Players Radio. Great to have you today.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's great to have you here. So, where to begin? One thing I'd really kind of like to ask you, I've read a lot about you and your books that you've had, and, I guess you kind of grew up a little more shy, a little more introverted, and then you get into the world of comedy, which really calls for somebody to be, the complete 180 of that. What was something that may have spoken to you, or what was maybe a eureka moment that made you realize that this is where you belonged?
I think it was that, honestly, I think it was that nothing else was working out for me.
Okay.
The short version is that when I graduated from college, I couldn't find a job. I couldn't keep a job because I got fired. The economy was bad, or I'd get laid off. Mm-hmm. And then I started temping. So it was one short-term job after another. And then a friend of mine took me to an open stage. He was doing open stages. And it was the mid-80s, big comedy boom, and especially in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to remember 3 minutes of material, and it just kind of took even that short amount. And then I got into a long-term comedy review, and I was just about to get fired from the latest job. So it dovetailed nicely. I am so lucky that it kind of found me, or I happened into it, that my friend brought me to that, because I have a lot of friends who work really hard. I've worked really hard, but it's not easy. And I think I'm over answering the question, but that's the long and the short of it. And it just, one thing just led to another. And I was just really lucky. Freelancing, doing comedy, writing, that kind of thing, was steadier employment than my previous job sequence. Does that answer the question?
Wow. And a lot of times that's always the opposite way, really, you know, really finding a way to make a living in entertainment and, you know, writing, comedy, acting, whatever it is, music. It really is, you know, a difficult thing than to have that be, you know, more steady for you.
I didn't know you could do it. Did you, Michael? Like, I watched The Tonight Show religiously, Carol Burnett. I watched all these shows, but it never occurred to me. I could not connect the dots that was a thing that people actually did, even though I was seeing people do it. But how would me do it?
I understand what you mean there. I mean, I came up from the other side, because I came up playing in bands, and that was a tough thing too. I mean, because you know doing comedy, you have one person to feed. In a band, you have five or four or something. Right. And you know, finding enough work that was, you know, where you didn't have club owners crying poverty at the end of the night. And
I know.
And, you know, I could tell, and I've told stories on the show too, you know, about, you know, when we would go from Baltimore to New York to play, sleeping in the band truck, sleeping in the U-Haul in the middle of New York City, coming home the next day, you know, just very, very meager accommodations to be able to accomplish. And there's nothing. And the thing is, it's like, you know, the minute you get a break or something like that, you know, everybody thinks you're rich all of a sudden. You know, do you ever get that?
Yes, I still do. And I am lucky, but I am not rich by any stretch of the imagination. And I think people are smarter or have a better sense of it, but it's still the leap is really interesting. The assumptions are really interesting.
Right. I mean, you get paid for the shows that you do and everything. You get your residuals and things like that coming in. But what people don't realize a lot of times too is those checks get smaller and smaller as time goes by, which is, you know, something else. And, you know, you don't, you know, get like $1 million for walking in the room. You know, there's pay scales and other things.
That percentage is like, there are actual numbers that, like, that percentage is like 0.002 who get that kind of, who are in the business and get that kind of payback, if you will.
Exactly. And one quote that, you know, I get, another thing that I kind of remember too, was in your book when you had, after Mystery Science Theater was over, and you had done, you know, taken some time to do some things, and you went back home, you know, with your parents to prepare to go to New York. You know, the one thing that they said to you when you were looking for something, they're like, oh, why don't you go be on CNN? Or why don't you go to Vegas and be in a show? You know, like you're just going to waltz into the room. And
yes, you know. My mother and my father, respectively. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yes, it was so sweet and earnest of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it is, you know, on that side of it. But again, that's kind of like another, you know, misassumption that people have, like, you know, just because, you know, you were on a network TV show, you're in good with, you know, Leno and they all know who you are and you can just come
watch it. The matter is like, I've never had an agent. I've never been able to get a manager. And again, the big leaps that, that people make, I guess I would do the same thing, but it's, we lost my mother in 2014. So saying that just brings up a lot of fond memories of,
yeah, yeah.
of her earnestness and her coming around to supporting my job choice, which wasn't my job choice. It just mm-hmm. happened.
Right.
I'm sorry, Michael, I keep interrupting you, but I appreciate this conversation.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. That's you're my guest, and that's we're here to hear all about you. So that's no problem at all. That's no problem at all. Some other things that I noticed too, and I'm just kind of bouncing around here. I really enjoyed both of the books, Employee of the Month and Other Big Deals, and Dumb Dumb Dumb, My Mother's Book Reviews. And again, you'd mentioned your mother. I just lost my father last year. But one thing that I noticed in the book was that Dumb 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 was that your mother was a fan of the, and I don't even know the name of the series, but the Detective Robichaux, which your mother spelled about four different ways, I think. My father was a huge fan of those books as well and had always recommended them over the years. But I really, if you want to maybe just talk about that book a little bit, Dumb Dumb Dumb, My Mother's Book Reviews, I guess I'll kind of set it up. If I remember correctly, you know, your mother had passed away and you found a box of index cards where your mother had written book reviews and all the books, you know, she was an avid reader. And you kind of took those to relate to different things in your life. You kind of categorize about four or five of them and they would kind of bring a memory together. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a memoir. I was, when we found this little recipe box, like a plastic recipe box full of sure. all these index cards, it just sort of prompted, I think I just start writing when I want to process something. So I think I was processing her death and reflecting on it. Mm-hmm. And those index cards with her, she would write down what she wrote and give these pithy little reviews because she started forgetting what she was reading because she read so much. Mm-hmm. So she wanted to make sure she wasn't rereading the same thing all the time. And so it's a memoir in a series of vignettes prompted by a lot of those book reviews. Mm-hmm. And I kind of group them thematically, or maybe there's a, verbiage that is similar, or her attitudes are reflected in certain groupings.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And I really liked how you were able to relate that to different phases of your life and everything. And you really had some funny stories in both books. And a lot of them were, just things that we both go through and some other things that, are part of everyday life. Some of the dating disasters you brought up, I thought were pretty funny. We all go through things like that. And I could probably write some books on some things that that I've been through. But I'd probably be better off waiting till some of these people were dead.
yeah, you want to tread lightly.
Yes. Yes. Looking at that, and also too, you really got some nice reviews on them. I saw on one of them, I believe it was this one here. Lorraine Newman and an original Saturday Night Live in the Groundling. How do you know her? How did you get to know her? Or don't you?
I don't really know her. We are Facebook friends.
Oh, okay.
I think actually I would have never had the gumption to send her a friend request. So she might have friended me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it blew my mind. And then every year she wishes me a happy birthday on Facebook. And at the time of the book, when I was compiling it and getting it toward its final stages, about a year ago, I think, I sort of mustered up all my courage and I grew up with her.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Know?
And I thought I was feeling really brave at that time. And so how did I do it? I must have sent it through Messenger.
Okay.
And of course, being the Minnesotan I am, I was like, could you? But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And then, you run away as fast as you can. So. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that is, and I hope I get to meet her in person because she just seems, I have just loved her on SNL.
Oh, yeah.
seeing those women on SNL and feeling like, oh, people do that.
Mm-hmm.
I just adore her.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And you know, she's a groundling. That's no joke either. You know,
thank you. Right.
I mean, the alumni and the current people that are groundlings, I mean, it's just, that's a who's who in entertainment right there.
Totally.
It really is. I had, I've had a couple of groundlings on the show. One of them was another founding member, Steve Bluestein, who worked with Fred Willard and Ace Trucking, and he has got some amazing stories too.
Oh my gosh.
That's part of the purpose for having this here is because it's an oral history, really. It started out being just people in my region, people that were kind of on the brink of hitting it big. A lot of the bands I've had on were huge in the Mid-Atlantic region, like the Rolling Stones around here, but you may not know them in Minnesota, example, right. And there's just so much good oral history. Hearing people's stories about, their lives working in the arts and show business and everything that I just thought it was worthwhile to keep this going. And again, I think you're nearly my 300th episode. And I've been doing this since 2018 and,
good on you, 2018 and you already right on. Wow.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And honestly too,
keep something going like this. So right on.
Right. Well, honestly too. And I kind of felt the same way about reaching out to you as you did to reach out to Lorraine Newman. You know, I was kind of, because, this show has always been one of my favorites. You know, I do watch it whenever I get a chance to, and I look at the ones on Tubi and, Netflix and everything. And, I think, being part of the whole ensemble there, I mean, you really did something that, they put things out there, they say are culturally significant. And I really think that, Mystery Science Theater has its, place in television history in a lot of things. The humor is very unique. There were no other shows out there like that, really. The unique sense of humor and just the fact that it's damn funny and it's clean. That's another thing too. I could sit down with my mother and I could sit down, you could sit down with kids and watch it. I mean, some of the things may, go over their head, but,
right.
You didn't have to delve into profanity or, go below the belt, use a lot of four-letter words. I mean, you were just damn funny and keeping it clean, which, really says a lot about that. Do you agree?
I think we had a sensibility in the writing room, most definitely. And I've often wondered how at Comedy Central, I don't think we really worked with standards and practices or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was standard when we were at Comedy Central. I know stuff came up at the Sci-Fi Channel. My point is, I've often wondered how you would review a script because the setup in the movie might be completely clean.
Yeah.
What we say, if you look at it on paper, is completely clean, but together they might be something totally filthy. So I think we got away with a little bit, like you said, going over some people's heads or moving in there fast and furious to just, be a little eyebrow raising.
Right.
But
right,
I think it was a general sensibility in the room. And then when we moved to the Sci-Fi Channel, we got a little more pushback. And I can't think of anything specific, but, there were lines that needed to be clarified or defended, and Comedy Central let us have more free rein, dirty or not, blue or not. It was, they were pretty hands off.
Right. I can't really remember anything that I recall. And again, I can't say that I've, I'm like the fan that you encountered that probably had every episode memorized, but I have seen, I have to say, at least the majority of the episodes, and I know who's who and what's what on the show. I can't really see, anything that I would even consider beyond PG or anything like that. you know, that came out on the show. And I really think that it takes a lot of brains to be able to maintain that when it comes to writing comedy nowadays, because that this is a whole other conversation. But really what's passing as comedy nowadays and a lot of these stand-up clubs and everything is just, I just feel like maybe people have just run out of gas or run out of new ideas. I mean, what do you think?
Oh boy, I don't know. I don't really see live comedy much anymore. Mm-hmm. I guess, and what I have seen has been pretty smart. So I don't know that if I have the same perspective. Honestly, I think it's always been that way, that they're always going to be. So I can't generalize to a generation or an era. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's always been that way, that some people are going to work really smart. Mm-hmm. Some people are going to work blue. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they're mutually exclusive, honestly. I mean, I know a lot of blue comics that I think are smart. For me, it depends on the particular comic.
Sure. Okay. Another thing, you're kind of getting back to the book reviews. And this is kind of something else that sort of ties into, everybody may be thinking that things are so glamorous all the time in show business. You had your first book, or one of the books, I think it was maybe Employee of the Month, came out, and you were offered to go on a bus tour on a Greyhound bus from city to city.
I lived with my parents.
Right.
Yeah. And it was a tiny book, and it was mortifying because it was just full of typos. It was a very small publisher. Mm-hmm. I think he was kind of a one man band. And I wrote it hastily, so I copped to that. Mm-hmm. And my favorite thing about it is my name got spelled wrong, even though there were fixes made that didn't need to be fixed in the, mm-hmm. the document. Right. And, my name was spelled wrong. And when I pointed that out to him, he said, "But we fact checked it," and which is the head exploding. And then I think he really thought this was going to be a big break for his publishing company. I can totally understand that. Guess what? I'm the wrong person for that. And he wanted me to go on a book tour. And that summer, Greyhound was offering $99 unlimited wherever you wanted in the US. And I have a lot of tenderness in my heart about it, but it's also really, oh my God. I didn't know how you do it. Like, do I take boxes of books with me on Greyhound? And I just couldn't imagine it, especially when I had friends who had quite a bit of success in the publishing world, and they talk about their book tours that were, you know, first class limousine at the airport. So, right. Yes, that's the long and short of that story.
Doing that on Greyhound, I'm kind of picturing John Candy in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles lugging that big trunk around with him from city to city.
Yeah, could you imagine? I mean, good on him. You know what? Good on him for like thinking of how it could be done. But I just, yeah, that didn't pan out.
Right. Something else here. I noticed in the your acknowledgments in the back of one of the books, you thank Joel Hoekstra. Is that from Trans-Siberian Orchestra, the guitar player?
No, the name is Joel Hoekstra.
Yeah.
And is there a guy by the same name in Trans-Siberian Orchestra?
Yes, he's the guitar player for Whitesnake, and he plays with Cher, and he also tours with Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Sorry, I don't know my musicians. How do you spell that last name?
Hoekstra.
Oh, interesting. No, this was an editor I worked with at Minnesota Monthly.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, where different Joel Hoekstra then.
Original essays appeared.
Oh, okay. So it must have been just a different person altogether then. Okay. I was wondering about that. I didn't know if you were, if you had connections to him. You know, maybe you're a White Snake fan or something.
Never even heard of him. My music knowledge is zero.
Sure. Another thing I noticed that you had mentioned was the Star Wars Christmas special. That's one of my favorites. And you had mentioned you were watching that, wondering how a Wookiee could get married or something. And
yeah, I was really upset that, you know, and this was back in the day where we didn't have the internet back in olden times. So it didn't have this widespread, this mass being out there in mm-hmm. in the world. And a friend of mine somehow got it on a VHS, which tells you how long ago it was.
Oh, yeah.
And I was at a frustrating and lonely time in my life. I was really, really shy, well into my late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. And I remember being so upset. So we're watching and we're laughing. And then Chewbacca introduces his wife. And I was indignant that even Chewbacca got, and I wasn't being ironic, I wasn't trying to be funny, it was like it just sort of reinforced, it was bias confirmation that everybody got to be in a relationship, even though it was fictional, but at the time I couldn't separate that.
Right. I had the writer of the Star Wars Christmas special on the show, you may know Bruce Valanche, who yes. was on Hollywood Squares. That was his,
of course. I had forgotten that.
Yeah. He told me a lot of stories about writing that and everything. And between that, he also did the Paul Lynde Halloween special.
Yeah.
And those variety shows were just such, you know, such a treasure from those days, aren't they?
Loved variety shows. Still do. Yep. Love that. Yep.
That was just great there. So I wanted to ask a little more, you kind of found out, you know, got into comedy, you know, you found where you should really be. And you connected with the people that you did Mystery Science Theater with, you know, I guess they must've been fellow comedians in the Twin Cities area, you know, performing comedy. And so how did you really come together or maybe get invited into being part of this production? Cause it was my understanding, maybe you weren't there from the beginning. It was maybe a season or two in.
It was the fourth season.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Fourth season. And I think maybe, I don't know, the second or third season on a cable channel, not local.
Like right.
It had
right.
moved on beyond local.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get invited in? Did they just say, come join us, or what was the process like?
I knew them all from doing stand-up, and I was so broke, I didn't even have a television. I couldn't right. afford a television. Mm-hmm. And so I had heard that they were doing something, but it was very abstract because I had never seen it, mm-hmm. and it seemed mythical to me. Uh-huh. And Bridget and I did comedy a lot together. And one night she called me up in my little apartment and she said, I'm sure I'm going to make this more dramatic than it actually was, but in my memory, this is how it went down. She called on the old school landline and she said, you didn't hear it from me, but Mystery Science Theater is looking for a new writer. And Mike was the head writer at that time. Mm-hmm. And she said, and don't tell Mike I told you. Click. I'm sure it was less mysterious than that. So it took me a couple of days and I mustered up all my courage. And obviously I had his phone number. We were all hanging out. Mm-hmm. And I called him up and I said, and this is my recollection too, I was so nervous. I said, so I just wanted to let you know, if you're ever looking for a writer, I was so scared. And he was, you know, beloved Mike. He said, well, yeah, you know what? We are looking at, you know, so augmenting the staff. And then he said, they sent me a packet, like a questionnaire and a portion of a movie to write. So I had the packet and then they invited me in for an audition. Mm, so okay. I wrote on two movies, I think, during a 2 or 3 week period.
Okay. So, so you auditioned pretty much by doing the show.
Actually, writing on a couple of episodes. Exactly.
So when you got to your audition, did you just, I guess, play the video and then kind of riff along with it? Was that your way, or did you?
I sent in the audition. It was it was a script, but then they invited me to actually do an actual movie. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So sit in on writing an actual movie, like the next step beyond the snippet that I did.
Right. So when you're writing these scripts, and I was kind of reading about how you put these together, you were all kind of sitting together on your couch, watching the movie on a big screen, and then I guess you're hitting the pause button quite a bit, huh?
Yeah, Mike was in charge of the remote, and he just has this really calm, steady demeanor, and we had big couches in the writing room, and his hand would be on the remote was on the couch, and that finger would pause whenever people were going nuts over a specific spot and throwing out lines. Yeah, it just listening to you tell about it. I mean, what a silly job. Just right. Going to work, reporting at 9 o'clock, sitting on a couch, watching TV. It was so great.
that's wonderful. And that's kind of how you put it together. And how did you decide which one would get the line? I know, because there was, Crow, Servo, and either Mike or Joel out there. Who would decide? Was that just something you kind of drew straws on, or was it?
No, we would divide up the script. Paul Chaplin and I would divide up the script to do line assign, like edit it down and pick the best lines in the best spot, because we tried never to talk too much over dialogue. Mm-hmm. So we would divide it up. And then when Bill Corbett came on board, he took a portion of the script also. We divide it up, do line assign. And pardon me. You just sort of developed this instinct or this sense of, you could hear it in different characters' voice. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of lines that would have worked with anyone because they were all such hilarious, great comedians. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you just knew it was a Crow line or a Mike line or a Servo line. You could just hear it in your head.
That's something. It's interesting. Interesting. It's always neat to kind of look behind the scenes of things and, how these things were made, that must have been, I see that you've been doing, you do reunions, you go out, you do your live, both, the riff tracks and the cinematic Titanic. Mm-hmm. And boy, there's a crew of you for cinematic Titanic, huh? There's, Do you still go out and do those live at different theaters, or is it?
No, I mean, if you're talking about Cinematic Titanic, that disbanded in 2013. Mm-hmm. So, no, occasionally I've done the live Riff Tracks shows.
Yeah, right.
And I love it. It's so much fun. People are so into it. And the great thing about it is, as opposed to stand-up comedy where you're the only one, and if you crater, you have to keep going. Mm-hmm. If your line blows, somebody's got another line right behind you, to pick it up. And and it's fun to work with those guys, all of them. It's just so fun. That group thing, that group comedy thing with those guys who I adore is just beyond.
I could just imagine, because, for being a performer myself, I've tried just about everything. I've played in bands, theater. I still do that, television, voiceover, just about everything out there. I did try stand up a couple of times, and good Lord.
Good Lord.
Oh, my God.
Say
something.
Say more, Michael. Say more. I want to. More, because I'm so immersed in it. I want to know, what that perspective is.
Well, I had gone out, I had an acoustic duo where we wrote silly songs that were ditties. But then there were a couple of times when I went out by myself. I just happened to be out somewhere. I had my guitar. Oh, look, open mic. I went in and tried it, both with the guitar and without. And God, I got to tell you, you know, if you always have it in your head where this is going to be the punchline right here, I'm going to get them with this one. And then when it falls flat, man, it's like getting punched in the gut. And you're like, and you got to recover from that. You got to make like nothing's wrong. Yeah. You got to make like nothing's wrong. You just got to keep going with it. You know, and, you know, I even had trouble because a lot of what I do, you know, as a day job is for many, many years, I was a trainer doing training classes. And that's hard enough. That's a rough enough crowd trying to do, you know, trying to talk a room full of construction workers into being safe.
Interesting, no doubt.
Yep. And then, you know, trying to make them laugh on top of that. Or even, and the thing is, too, is that some of these open mics, the crowds are hostile anyhow, because you're either in a room full of other comedians or you're in a room full of people that bring their friends and they tell them just to laugh at them and nobody else.
Yeah.
And to try to break through that. But I mean, you have no guitar. You know, you have just yourself and your own wits to try to pull yourself out of that. And if, you know, things start going south, you know, you got to get your hand on that steering wheel and pull that spinning car out of the median strip. And that is probably, I think that is probably mentally the most challenging form of entertainment you could ever come up with to do. And believe me, my hats are off to people who are able to do that successfully. You know, and you know, I mean, even when I go to a comedy club, you know, and you know, I'm not somebody, you know, having been a performer, I'm not somebody who would ever go out and boo anybody, even if they were bad or even if they were right. Jerks
Thank on
stage.
Excuse me.
You know, I always make sure, even if something isn't my cup of tea, you know, I give, you know, good kudos to somebody who's willing to go out and make the effort. Now that there's some things I won't tolerate, like, you know, arrogant behavior from somebody or if somebody's a jerk to other performers, then the hell with them. But just having enough respect for people that have the guts to get up and do something, you know, it's, you know, my hat goes off to that, you know, especially stand-up comedians, because that is just a rough. It's probably the toughest thing. I mean, do you agree?
No, I think that sword swallowing would be pretty hard. No, that's why I was curious to get your take on it, because I made my bones doing it, and everything you're saying is absolutely right. And I think I'm at a point in my stage life where that is all still really true. But I have a little more legs under me, and I'm at a certain age. I've been really fortunate to build many different things. So it doesn't freak me out the way it used to.
Sure.
Because I remember there was a time when I was a middle act and I was getting paid $25, right? But in those days, you just did whatever work you could for whatever amount. And I was broke and I did it for $25 and I did my middle act and I bombed. And I was so mortified that I gave the money back to the club owner because I felt like I hadn't delivered the product, right? And if I had a bad set, I would go home and crawl, like, I took it so seriously and personally. And I kind of love being this age and having this much experience because it actually makes me do a better job to be real, really authentic in my storytelling and my stand-up comedy. And I still get to go home. And if I made people laugh, that is great. If I made people go home and not think twice about me, that's okay too. I just take it so I want to do a great job, but I don't take it as to heart. Am I making sense? Do you know what I mean?
You're making a lot of sense.
You know, it's like, oh, life goes on. Like that night that I gave the money back, thinking that I'd never eat lunch in this town again. Yeah, I kind of overinflated it, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And So, I'll stop rambling because I'm trying to still name what it is. Mm-hmm. I actually care more about what I'm doing in a different way, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm having more of a conversation with audiences being who I am, and people can take it or leave it. And that is totally fine. I guess I'm a little more zen about it. Okay, mm-hmm. I'll hang up and listen, Michael.
Yeah. Well, another thing that, you know, kind of getting at, and I've heard, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts myself as well as having one. And I listen to a lot of comedians, and I've had a number of comedians on here. And, you know, another thing that people don't realize is that, you know, you could go knock them dead one night and bomb the next.
Yes, 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 yes. Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah, right. I just headlined in at a small club that I absolutely love in Minneapolis in September. And Friday was killer, mm-hmm. right? Saturday was like I had never done comedy before. And yep. So there's really interesting awareness mm-hmm. of the nature of the beast.
Right, right. I have experience with that as well too. You know, I own a murder mystery company, and we do our, you know, whoever will have us, you know, a lot of it are riverboats, trains, oh, wow. Galas, fundraisers, breweries, wineries,
wow, right.
you know, all kinds of things like that. And it's improv. We have a storyline, but there's no written in stone script.
Right.
And the thing is like, I've noticed sometimes on the train, we're doing the show three times, you know, this car is one scene.
Oh,
and then
man.
This car is the second scene.
Wow. Right.
Okay. And the thing is, it's like, we've do the same scene. This car, we knocked them dead. The next car, tumbleweeds. And the third car, you may get like a lukewarm. And then you come back at you the next scene. You know, dynamite, lukewarm, tumbleweeds. Yes. You never know with that. And there's a lot of things that kind of factor into that as well. But I got to tell you, you know, there's nothing more rewarding than hitting one out of the park, you know?
Totally. And I think all that points to the thing that has been important to me is figuring out that since I can't predict or manage mm-hmm. the outcome, all I can do is the best I can do. And even if I'm doing a show and the audience is lukewarm mm-hmm. or there's only four of them, I still want to do the best thing that I can, mm-hmm. you know, and it's taken me a long time to commit to that. Like, understanding it intellectually is a different thing mm-hmm. than getting up there and delivering that ethos. And the one thing I did know is that when I was doing stand-up in the 80s with all my compeers, there were a million of us doing different shows with different people at different nights, it always really bothered me when people blamed the audience.
Mm-hmm.
When people would yell at the audience to their face or get off stage. And yeah, there were some dead audiences. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of neither here nor there. Does that make sense?
Right, like, right, right.
You got to get out there and keep working your material and do your thing. And you don't know where they're at. Mm-hmm. Just so.
Right. And the thing is, too, is that I mean, sometimes when I'm watching something and I think something's hilarious on TV, but I may not be, you know, laughing out loud at it, but inside I'm cracking the hell up. You can have audience members like that too. I mean, there's been times when, you know, cause usually what we do is, you know, as people are leaving the show, we have like the reception line to greet everybody and say, thank you for coming. And, you know, some people are like, my God, you guys were hilarious. But I was like, well, I wouldn't have known by listening to you guys, you know?
Exactly.
Yep. Another thing too that you kind of mentioned, you know, whether there's four people in the room or the one thing that I've learned to kind of adapt to as well is when you get a big room of people and they're laughing and it's a positive response, that energy just takes you over.
Absolutely.
And when you just have a little group like that, you really got to learn how to compensate for that energy and give them the same show that you would have sold out room too. Sometimes that's difficult, but I've learned how to do that. But I do find that those people feel a lot more personal about the performance, and they'll come see you again.
Yeah. And a sold out room isn't a guarantee either.
Oh, right.
Oh,
you're preaching to the choir there, man. Yeah. God. Right.
I mean, so it's so again, like brings me back to, okay, then what is the work? What do I mm-hmm. want to be saying with my comedy? How can I have a conversation with mm-hmm. whoever, whatever this group is?
Right. Right. And you got another thing too, is that, yeah, you know, and I've done this in the past too. I've had a couple of like, Mr. Saturday Night moments, in the band where somebody, you know, we're up there doing our acoustic duo. Somebody did something or said something and I've snapped at them a couple of times and it just kind of,
you mean in the audience?
Yeah.
Like in the audience?
Yeah.
Like giving you shit?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And I bit back.
And I I feel you. Yeah.
There it goes, you know. I was able to win the crowd back after a while, but, you know, for a song or so, it was just kind of like, you know. Oof.
Yeah, you kind of like shoot yourself in the foot doing that. And mm-hmm. And then people get in the audience get weird about it. And I think it's got to be totally different when you're a musician, because when you're doing stand-up comedy, it's an expected protocol that you are going to put that person in their place or make mm-hmm. them shut up or engage them and see where it goes. But
right.
In music, you don't really have that leeway mm-hmm. or leverage.
Yep. If somebody says something, all right, 2, 3, 4, you know, and you can go right back into playing and just kind of drown them out and people forget about it. But
exactly. Right.
You know, again, you know, stand-up comedy, it's just you. Self-reliance to the hilt right there, you know. It's just
boy, you're really freaking me out now. I don't think I'll ever do stand up again. You really break it down. It's like, oh shit, that is what I do.
Well, you know, like I said, you know, it's very well. Yeah, another thing I wanted to mention to you too that I just absolutely loved was I was looking through, you know, the Mary Jo Peel show, the Mary Tyler Moore intros that you put together for those. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I give all props to producer Chris Gersbeck, who came up with all the visuals, and mm-hmm. it felt a little, having been weaned on the Mary Tyler Moore show.
Oh yeah.
It felt a little overly proprietary.
Mm-hmm.
Like I wasn't really entitled, but we hope it's regarded as an homage.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, you know, that font had its roots much well before Mary Tyler Moore show made it popular or well known. But well, thanks. Yeah, that's all Chris Gersbeck.
I think that would be taken as an homage. I mean, I would, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, you weren't doing that and trying to take credit for something Mary Tyler Moore did, obviously, right. You know, I mean, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, if somebody did that with something of mine, I'd be honored. I mean, especially somebody, you know, coming from somebody the caliber of you, you know,
it's not like I am very, I try to be really sensitive about appropriating other people's mm-hmm. work.
Sure, sure.
And a lot of people do that without even knowing it or just feel like they're entitled to it. Mm-hmm. And this font was out there. And yeah, it is very, but it is definitely salute to the American.
Oh, yeah. And the fact that you're from Minnesota, where as she was, and I'm sure that show was probably huge there. In the 70s. It was everywhere, but I'm sure
it, like the house that they show as her apartment mm-hmm. is always in the news, like who's buying it, what they've done with it. There's a Mary, I don't know if you knew this, there's a Mary Tyler Moore statue.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The Nicollet Mall, which is a shopping thoroughfare in downtown mm-hmm. Minneapolis, with her throwing her hat. So yes, we claim her like we claim Lizzo and Prince, and mm-hmm. absolutely.
Oh, absolutely! I've seen that statue. I actually took a selfie with it about 10 years ago.
Okay.
I was out there for business. I was out there on April 16th, and they got a foot and a half of snow. And yes,
that's on brand. Absolutely.
I was like, you're not in Maryland anymore. I'll tell you that. But it was a nice city. I mean, I really enjoyed walking around down there and, looking around downtown. It was Minneapolis. It was the Minneapolis side, not St. Paul. Right.
Correct. I think.
Well, I knew I was with the statue and, it was actually really neat to see that, cause that was constantly on in my house growing up too. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, my mother loved it. My wife, we watch it on reruns whenever we can. That's just,
it
one of those
still
great
holds
ones.
Up. It is so, yeah, mm-hmm. near and dear. Yeah.
Yep. Well, that's another thing too. You mentioned holding up, your work, definitely holds up, I mean, it's still funny. God, some of that stuff is what, 25 years old, I guess, right?
Yeah. You're talking about the MST stuff. When did I start? Like 1992, I started. And so I think it started in 1989. So what is that? Mm-hmm. 99, 2009.
34 years.
30 plus years.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's just great, Okay. Well, I tell you what I'd like to do right now, and I've really enjoyed this conversation with you. And again, thank you for agreeing to do this. I'd like to ask you, right now, this is what I call the shameless plug portion of the show. You can shamelessly plug anything with, no shamelessness, I haven't
I'm pretty shameless, so I'm brave, so you don't need to qualify it at all.
Appearances, performances, your books, website, whatever you got, go.
Well, I hope you'll check out the riff tracks I do with Bridget Jones Nelson. That's mm-hmm. Riff Tracks, and they've got a whole library of Mike, Kevin, and Bill too. It's so great. And my book, Dumb, 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 My Mother's Book Reviews, is available on Red Hawk. One word, Red Hawk Publishing. Thank you, good sir. Mm-hmm. Red Hawk Publishing. And you can go to my website, mjpeel.com. There's a link there. And I do my streaming show once a month, and that is Dumb Industries. Just Google Dumb Industry.
I saw
a mere
that.
Coincidence about the titles. So.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Well, Mary Jo, thank you so much. I really appreciate, again, you getting to talk to somebody who has been a big part of one of my favorite shows ever. Love your humor, love your books. Just thank you so much for, being willing to spend time with us today on Foul Players Radio.
My absolute pleasure. What a fun conversation. Thank you.
Well, folks, we've had Mary Jo Peel with us today, a.k.a. Pearl Forrester and many other things. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you next time.
Hi, this is Paul Castiglia, and you're listening to Foul Players Radio, the one-stop shop for all your pop culture needs.
Hi, everybody. Dwight Weems from Gaz the Fun Band, and you're watching and listening to Foul Players Radio.